Welcome to Parents' Perspective. All right, class, Mrs. Porter looked at her group of fifth graders. I hope you've all brought in your opinion articles from the newspapers about the proposed new stadium. The students dug into their desks and retrieved their crumpled newspaper articles. Alice's hand shot up. May I go first, Mrs. Porter? Mrs. Porter nodded. Remember to give the journalist's name first. My article is by Charles Brenner. He writes for the Sun-Telegraph. Alice began, but he says a bunch of criminals are involved in the stadium project, and it would be bad. Wait! Henry's hand went up. My article says that it's only if they use the Cannon Company for construction. There are other companies, but the big thing is, Billy's voice carried over the others, we need a stadium to keep the team in town. We don't want to lose the team. Monica, Mrs. Porter looked at the far corner of the room, you've had your hand up for a while. Monica stood up. My article was by Don Richards for the Daily News, and he's been looking at the city records of who owns the land and what will happen to people who live there now. Where do people go? Amy called out. Does the government have the right to make them give up their houses? Asked Carl. That's not fair. From a parent's perspective, does exposure to investigative journalism help develop our kids' reasoning skills? And what can we expect with the decline of our daily newspapers? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest knows about investigative journalism and the newspaper business from his own experience. Steve Luxenberg, an associate editor at The Washington Post, has worked for more than 30 years as a newspaper editor and reporter. Steve has given talks and workshops about journalism issues and nonfiction writing at universities and other discussion forums, including in the media. His new book, Annie's Ghosts, is both a memoir and a detective story. He's married and the father of two grown children, a boy and a girl. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Steve.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
In today's world, we often hear about the imminent demise of newspapers and potential decline of what we know as investigative journalism. How do you see changes to your profession in today's world?
This is the word used, or the phrase used, imminent demise. I think instead we're seeing an evolution that we will not see print newspapers go away completely anytime soon. It probably will be 20 years, I would say, before we see print newspapers perhaps go out of business to be replaced by something cheaper, because paper is expensive, electronic journalism. Newspapers right now, news organizations, I'd like to say, because we shouldn't get stuck with the idea of news having to be distributed on a paper form. But we're evolving and trying to figure this out. And you can't really talk about the newspaper industry as being one tier. I work for, fortunately, one of the ones with more resources, and it's better off. And even though we are having a decline in advertising, some of those revenues will come back. We're still doing a lot of in-depth reporting and trying to figure out the best way to distribute it. Community newspapers in America are actually doing quite well because in those markets, a lot of those markets, that's the only advertising vehicle in town. So they're not suffering some of the advertising decline that other papers are. I'd like to say, though, that with many historical changes, it's wrong, I think, to think that investigative reporting is the norm in journalism. It really came into being as a part of the mass media in the 70s with Watergate and thereafter. There were the muckrakers in the early part of the 20th century, but for the most part, newspapers were not too interested in investigative reporting until Vietnam in the 70s, as something that you would expect in almost every newspaper. Instead of seeing the newspaper as a profession, it's a witness to famous events. So we shouldn't look at this period, you know, with a big hue and cry and say, oh, I'm so worried about our newspapers. For a long time, newspapers didn't do this.
So where would people and students in particular be exposed to this kind of critical thinking type of skill?
Well, I think critical thinking comes in almost every news story. You don't have to be an investigative reporter. Let's define what that means. I always like to joke that the investigative reporter is the man or woman sitting over there in the corner who doesn't have to produce every day. All reporters are doing investigative reporting in the sense that if they're doing their job well, they're not just reproducing somebody's handout. They're asking critical questions. So I think it's more important to ask the question as parents, and I'm a parent, as you said, of two grown children. How do you develop critical thinking skills? Whether those critical thinking skills are used in newspaper writing or editing or in politics or in government work or in science or whatever it is. We all need critical thinking skills. And I certainly am not going to tell my kids they need to go into journalism. In fact, in today's age, I would be asking them to go into something unstable. But I do want them to have critical thinking skills. And so I'd like to focus more on how you develop those regardless of how they're used. One of the things that would be great is if teachers saw news articles as a tool in their classroom. And I don't think many do. They wouldn't bring in an article like the one you described in your hypothetical fifth grade class. They have a curriculum. That curriculum is bound by the things that they're supposed to do. And many of them are not creative enough, I think, to bring in newspaper articles as a point of discussion. I know some teachers who are very creative and do something like that. I'm going to talk about some of them today. They know much more than I do about how to develop critical thinking skills. But I don't think that newspapers are seen as quite the tool that they were perhaps 20, 30 years ago.
It's interesting. I was thinking all of us are old enough around this table to have had a course in what used to be called civics long ago. I don't think that exists anymore. And that's why we were thinking that the newspapers are maybe the last bastion of how kids learn about sort of what's going on in the world and why it's important to know and how the critical thinking skills sort of come into that.
I know in the Baltimore system, social studies is not a required topic in elementary and middle school. That's a big problem.
Oops.
I don't know how true that is in other school systems across the country, but when they look at these accountability tests, which I think we would all be generally in favor of as a measurement of how we're doing, it also creates a problem because there's only so many hours in the day and you can only cram so many things into those hours. So once you start doing English and math and science, et cetera, what do you leave out? Well, in some places they leave out art, music. Social studies is one of the topics that I think that it gets left out often. Now, you could argue that history is something that shouldn't be taught until a certain age because kids don't have the critical thinking skills yet to analyze that history, and it doesn't do them any good to just give them a bunch of facts. I think one of the main issues is my daughter, who is a college graduate, was amazed that some of the private school kids who came to her college had never written what she called a true research paper. They didn't know how to do research, and they struggled in their freshman year. I was amazed by this because these were high schools that you pay a lot of money to go to, and the idea that they hadn't done a really thorough research paper, which she had as part of her international baccalaureate program. One way to develop critical thinking skills in high school is to have an IB program, which is focused on the thinking skills more than it is on the accumulation of knowledge. And you're tested at the end of it, and you can't graduate without passing those tests. How do you get to the point where in high school the students are ready to do the kind of investigating of whatever topic it is, whether it's journalism or history or research? How do you get to that point? And I think there are a couple of things we can talk about that are good ways to get them ready for that. One of the ways in Baltimore, I happen to be participating in this as a volunteer, is the Baltimore Urban Debate League, which has now pushed that skill down to the middle school level. And so you have 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And in fact, elementary school kids are coming into the tournaments. These are monthly or every 6-week tournaments that are held on Saturdays. So it's an extracurricular activity. And you would be amazed, 200 kids who could spend their Saturdays doing something else coming together to debate in pairs of two against another team. And in order to do that, they have to do research, and they have to do writing, and they have to do public speaking in order to participate in the matches. It's a wonderful way to introduce them to things that are outside of their usual expertise. And it's wonderful to see these kids. They get awards for individual speaking, for teams, and for their school. And I think it's a great success. Sometimes I worry about the topics, because they seem to be over the heads. And that's a huge age range from fifth grade to eighth grade. That's a huge range of age. And the last topic was the Baltimore City government should provide housing vouchers to homeless people as a way of trying to solve homelessness. Well, in order to debate that topic, you have to understand what a voucher is. You have to understand how governments subsidize programs, that it's not a cash program. It's a subsidy in the form of a voucher that you can't spend any other way. And that's a pretty sophisticated level of thinking for a fifth grader, for example, to grasp. On the other hand, once you've been introduced to it as a fifth grader, your critical thinking skills are way ahead. So I think that's a quite interesting way to think about critical thinking.
We'll take a short break and be right back to continue our discussion on the effects of investigative journalism on our children's reasoning skills.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Steve Luxenberg about how investigative journalism influences reasoning skills. What kinds of critical thinking and writing skills are fostered by a steady diet of good journalism that middle school and high school students can be exposed to?
I think that you can look at some skills that can be developed through activities that the kids think are fun. I have a friend who teaches in the Baltimore schools in a charter school, and he created for 7th and 8th graders a mock trial in which they were researching, of all things, the court-martial of Lieutenant Calley, the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. And the kids took on the roles of everybody in the trial. Somebody played Lieutenant Calley. One person was the Army prosecutor. Somebody was the defense lawyer. Somebody was the judge. Everybody else were witnesses. And they had to thoroughly know the case in order to perform their part of the mock trial. But the kids loved doing it. And yet, if you think about it, all of the things they had to do in this activity were journalistic. They had to interview each other. They had to read about the case. They had to learn the law. So I think that was a wonderful activity, which kids had a lot of fun in because there was an acting component to it.
How do you feel kids are affected when they lack exposure to high-caliber thinking and writing skills?
I think it's silly to cram kids with lots of facts and not try to advance critical writing and thinking skills. That should be the goal of all education at all levels in every year. I know with my own kids, somehow we've developed a good rapport because I would imagine it's not easy to have a writer for a father. And yet my kids, even at the ages of 25 and 23, still are willing to show me things, and my wife, meaning that we obviously haven't killed the creative spirit in them by whatever our review was of their work. And that's a tough skill because that's what we're really talking about. Still, I think that at every age, kids ought to write. Because the more that you write in whatever form it is, the more that you're trying to figure out how the world works. The thing we need to resist, and I think this is really, really important, is what I call the cut-and-paste society. We have taught kids with the internet that it's fine to go and grab material from the internet, paste it into a document, and call that their own work. It's not even that it's plagiarism. That's a different issue. It's that you don't even know what the quality of the work is that you just grabbed. And I think a lot of teachers allow kids to get away with this.
I didn't know that.
So easy. You know, and of course, some professional journalists have gotten waylaid by the fact that they cut and paste something from the internet into notes, and they didn't mark it clearly enough in their notes and ended up creeping into their own work, and then it was plagiarism. We didn't have the tools when we were in the 60s and 70s to just cut and paste things. It wasn't easy to do. If you took notes from a book, you had to do it with your own hand, and it was laborious. And I love the internet. It's much more efficient. But a cut and paste way of thinking is not critical thinking. It's rote thinking in an electronic form.
It's not running it through your brain and using it.
No. And I think my wife was a school librarian, retired now. one of her jobs at the library was to do research skills with the kids. Every semester, she spent several classes on how do you know that what you're reading on the internet is verifiable? How do you know that it's good material? How do you know that it's accurate? How do you trust this website? Why should you trust this website? And kids are kind of amazed. Well, if it's there in print, it must be true. And of course, it's not only is it not true, but in some ways, we've just created the proliferation of facts that are hard to check in some ways because you don't know what the source was to begin with, as opposed to when we were younger where everything was footnoted and, you know, et cetera.
As parents and other concerned adults, how can we ensure that our kids encounter good critical thinking and writing regularly? That's why we started with the newspaper. How can we encourage them to learn from that?
I think this is a hard question to answer in the modern age because let's think about how, as kids, you look at the world. Your first line of attack is your family. And there's the issue of whether the family has time, energy, and resources to provide some of that critical thinking as you're at the breakfast table or the lunch table or dinner table. So it seems to me that you can bring the newspaper to the breakfast table, except if there's no newspaper, then you can't bring it. And I don't think we're going to sit around with four computers and all be looking at our screens while we're chewing on our chocolate chip muffins.
Or discussing anything with your computer screen in front of you.
Right. I think that we're going to have to adjust. I mean, I know that at my dining table, one or the other of the four of us, when we're all together, might bring a printout of something from a computer and read it the way you would have read aloud from a newspaper. Of course, in my household, we're not going to do without a newspaper. And we have a tradition in the house of reading aloud to each other. And often, my kids in particular love to pick up examples of the bad use of language. I don't mean profanity. I mean the use of language in a way that's humorous because it's not written in the way that you intended to. And obviously, they've accumulated that love of language from their parents in part. So the first line is, what can parents do? And I think that we all have to find ways to make the world around us, the civics lesson that we perhaps don't get anymore in eighth grade, part of our family discussions. I wouldn't impose that on any family, but I certainly would want to be a part of a family that did that. Then the next line of attack, of course, is the school. And I think that, of course, school systems provide a lot of resources for teachers to bring things in one way or another. Most schools, not all schools, have working computers. Then there's the extracurricular things that kids can get involved in, like the Urban Debate League that I talked about. A lot of teachers, I think, are so constrained by the curriculum that they are required to teach that they don't feel comfortable going outside of that. This one teacher I referred to who did the mock trial also does all kinds of things with his kids where he takes them on field trips, camping trips, he takes them to museums, all in an attempt to say there's a bigger world around you. And he will often create a project. I know that one thing he did was trying to get kids interested in the questions about the environment. So he created a project in which they had to research whether it was environmentally sound to do one thing or another. The lovely thing I thought about that project was that it didn't assume that just because you call it environmental that it is in fact doing anything good for the environment. And that's part of the critical thinking and teaching that we have to do. We have to have teachers asking questions and not stating facts and principles and all that. I think that there's the home, there's the parents, there's the school, and then there's extracurricular activities. And all of those have to be working together. I think the best school systems are one that recognize that there is a value to having parents involved in the school. Some school systems I've seen are not so interested in having parents involved. They feel that they're being watched or looked over their shoulder. I think the best school systems have figured out that tricky, delicate balance between having parents come into the classroom or into the school in the evenings and be a part of the school environment. And you can tell when you walk into a school when there's energy and there's liveliness and there's creativity and when there's not.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on the effects of investigative journalism on our children's reasoning skills.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 800-273-2015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Steve Luxenberg about how investigative journalism influences reasoning skills. What kind of responsibility do you feel that the print media has to the development of a public with strong critical thinking skills?
Well, the blunt answer to that question is none.
It's not your job.
It's not our job.
Okay.
But it is in our interest to develop those skills, because if the newspaper or the news articles, whatever form, remember, let's get away from print, whatever form the news comes into the classroom, you're building a next generation of people who are interested in the news. And at least at this point, we are still in a profit-making business model. I would like to say that we don't shape the news on the basis of advertisers or our profit-making margins. But we're all very aware that we can't operate. We can't pay salaries. We can't pay expenses if we don't have revenue. And one of the difficulties, of course, now is that we've taught a whole generation of readers to expect that news is free. You can get it on the internet. It doesn't bring in a lot of revenue when something is free. And it's expensive to do reporting. It's expensive to have a bureau in Baghdad, as we do. It's in our interest to make partners out of school systems so that we can bring our news gathering into the classroom and the idea of news into the classroom. Newspapers have done this for generations, actually, now. There are newspapers in the classroom programs probably in most major school systems in the country. Less so today, because, again, it's an expense. We're providing that for free to those classrooms. And if it's not being used or it's being used poorly, then most newspapers aren't going to be interested in it. So I think that if we're smart, we will do a lot of things beyond just bringing the newspaper into the classroom. The paper that I work for in Washington has a partnership with the District of Columbia school systems to do mentoring and bringing journalists into high schools to act as, on one hand, talent scouts for the next generation. So we identify those students who might be the next generation of journalists, but also just as a kind of measure of saying, hey, among all your choices out there in the world, why don't you consider journalism as one of them? I think that's a smart thing for us to do. It's also a responsible thing for us to do. I don't think that the part of responsibility is our main motivation there. We journalists still think of ourselves as having a modicum of acting in the public interest. We don't always act in the public interest, but we do consider that to be part of our responsibility. We do take, I think, that part of it seriously when we're not worrying about whether we're going to exist.
Well, this is obviously a conversation that's topical and important and could go on for a very long time, but unfortunately we have to close. But before we do, what resources would you suggest for listeners who want to further pursue some of the issues we've been discussing?
I would look at this broadly and not be confining ourselves to journalism. I would look at the activities that the school either has or could have that would foster critical writing skills. A lot of professions, the mock trial format that I talked about before, comes out of perhaps a lawyer would be more interested in that sort of an activity, but I think we all should be interested in those activities that foster these skills. I would take proactive course of action if I were in the school system, and I would go to some of the community resources, the government, corporations, newspapers, and I would ask them for their involvement. I would bring in people who are able to contribute to the school. I think most people would be more than willing to do that. I think we have to stop thinking of our kids as reservoirs that we just try to fill up with information. We need to provoke them. The best schools are the ones that parents are involved in. And if they don't see that, then they're shortchanging their own kids, because the better the quality of critical writing and thinking is around their children, the better their prospects are that their children are going to make it in a very increasingly complicated and difficult world. So parents need to go to the schools and be involved. If I were a parent or a teacher, I would see the public library as a great resource. Libraries are expensive. So a lot of schools, if they maintain one, what they're maintaining is a circulation system of a couple of thousand, 5,000 books. They don't have extensive subscriptions to databases and other resources because it costs a monthly fee. But the public library is another resource for that. And you can call it up on most computers right in your school. The wealth of material that's out there is overwhelming. The problem isn't the amount of resources, it's the time and the direction of the teacher to manage those resources. There's lots of things for free. It doesn't cost school systems a lot of money if they're creative.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation, and it's been a lot of interesting suggestions for ways that parents can be involved. So, Steve Luxenberg, thank you so much for being with us and talking about critical thinking and writing skills for children.
It was a wonderful conversation, and I'm certainly glad to have been here today.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Steve Luxenberg's book, Annie's Ghosts, A Journey into a Family Secret. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 421 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the Adele M. Thomas Charitable Foundation, Incorporated. We often thank individuals or organizations for their generous donations that help with the cost of producing Parents' Perspective programming. Parents' Perspective, Incorporated is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Today, we thank you, our listeners, for your tax-deductible contributions to our annual fundraising campaign. Donations can be made online through GiveDirect or iGive.com, or Mission Fish at eBay, or you can mail checks or money orders to Parents' Perspective Incorporated, Post Office Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015. Thank you for helping us continue to work for you. Our sound engineer is Elizabeth Buckle. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.